choice is in your hands.
Britain decides.
Most of the countries in the world are outside the European Union, and they're doing very nicely, thank you.
Britain decides.
I believe that Britain will be safer, stronger, and better off in a reformed European Union.
You're listening to Britain Decides, the EU referendum debate on TRE.
It's the most profound political decision of my lifetime.
Britain decides.
With Stephen Ritson.
It's time to speak up.
And welcome to the sixth edition of our special programmes dedicated to the British referendum on membership of the European Union to take place on the 23rd of June. Just looking at our unscientific website, it currently stands at 58.5% of you wish to remain, 38.7% want to leave, and 2.8% are undecided. As far as the bookies in the UK is concerned, stay is 11-2 odds on, and leave is 4-1. So the bookies very much have it that the British population, those who can vote, will choose to remain in the European Union. A little later on in the programme, I'll be speaking to Doug Nicholls, who is the chair of Trade Unionists Against the European Union. He's a former General Secretary of the General Federation of Trade Unions. As you may know, most trade unions seem to have come out in favour of remaining. This would appear to be an exception. We'll be joining him a little later on. And Vicky Price, the renowned economist, among other things, she was Chief Secretary to the Treasury in the UK. She's held many significant roles, including head of the UK Government Economic Services. She's written a book called Greekonomics. And of course, this on the day where Greece has received a final tranche of its bailout from the Eurozone, and the IMF managed to come to a late-night deal with Europe over that. But first of all, we're joined on the line by James McGrory. He's chief campaign spokesman for Britain Stronger in Europe, and they, of course, are the lead campaign for Britain to remain in the European Union. He also wants to encourage as many expats as possible to vote in the 23rd of June referendum. He's in his campaign headquarters in central London, I understand. Afternoon, James.
Afternoon. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Thanks for your patience waiting on the line. So first of all, before we get into the, let's say, the ins and outs of this, just the actual issue of registering to vote, the postal vote, if people haven't registered, that deadline has already passed. That was just about a week ago, just over. But people still have the chance to register to vote if they want to use a proxy or go in person.
That's right. I'm afraid, yeah, any of your listeners that wanted a postal vote, I'm afraid that ship has sailed, unfortunately. But that doesn't mean they can't have their say in this crucial decision we're going to take as a country. If there's anyone listening who's unsure, they would have to, if they're not registered, if they're not on the electoral register, they'd have to do that by the 7th of June. It's quite straightforward. Takes 5 minutes. You can do it while you're boiling the kettle. Although if the weather's good over there, they might not be doing that while they're making a cold drink. So do that by the 7th of June, and then you can apply for a proxy vote where someone goes and votes in your stead over here by the 15th of June, or as you say, if they're really keen, they can obviously fly or get the ferry back and vote themselves in person. But, you know, whatever your views, I'm clearly on the Remain side of the argument, but whatever your views, I'd urge everyone in this country, and indeed Brits living in Europe, to very much have their say, because it's going to affect all of us.
The proxy vote, I understand a key point for our listeners, is the person who votes on your behalf must themselves be a registered voter. They must be on the electoral roll as well. Presumably, do people need something like a power of attorney, something like that?
It's not quite that serious, but you do have to sign a few documents, and as does the other person involved, and register properly with the authorities. I think rather than me and you try and talk people through it, I'd urge people to go onto the Electoral Commission website, which has very clear guidance for applying for a proxy vote, and indeed for expats living on the continent, for how they can secure a proxy vote and indeed register. So I think that might be the best thing to direct people to.
Okay, I think there are a few places. One is gov.uk /register-2-vote. That's one way.
Yep.
And I understand there's another website which might be easier to remember, which is aboutmyvote.co.uk, which has that information on it as well. What do you think about this decision? It was maybe not unexpected. The Supreme Court, I think it was yesterday, confirmed what we'd believed to have been the case, that expats who've lived outside the UK for over 15 years will not be allowed to register to vote. This case, of course, brought
solicitors in London on behalf of a 92-year-old war veteran who's living in Italy. What do you think about the ethics of that and the morality of it?
Been an issue, as you know, that's been live for a few elections now, not just for this referendum. There have been challenges in the past about this so-called 15-year rule, where if you're a Brit who's been living abroad for longer than 15 years, you're not entitled to vote in a general election or indeed in this referendum. Look, I'm afraid I have to give you a slightly boring answer here, because as a campaign, we're responsible for fighting an election on the franchise that is dictated to us by the authorities, and it's not really right for us to be trying to be seen to influence what that franchise is. So we just have to, you know, accept the decisions of government and indeed of the court here, and fight the referendum on the franchise that is.
Okay, so it does seem curious that, on the one hand, the Votes for Life bill is due to be passed before the 2020 general election. So it seemed that the principle that one has left the UK and therefore shouldn't have the right to vote is not so clear, because it looks as though it's going to be passed. And the other thing, it seems that when it came to this particular one, disenfranchising so many people, including myself, I have to say, as a Brit living abroad in the European Union for all these years in different places, that in fact it was the House of Lords, rather cheekily some might say, voted two-thirds against, and yet, unlike in a general election where they don't have the right to vote, members of the House of Lords are allowed to vote in this one. I would have expected from your side, I would have expected a bit more of a fight, as one might assume that British people living the 2.2 million or whatever, however many we are, the ones living in the European Union, would presumably have a greater tendency, out of self-interest perhaps, to vote for your side. I'm surprised that you didn't put up more of a fight.
Well, look, I think you've got to be very careful as a campaign that, you know, this election is seen to be fair. And, you know, I can totally understand why other people, including yourself, feel very strongly about this and indeed are, you know, challenging this decision. As you say, there may well be movement on this in the future. But the campaign itself, it's very difficult thing to challenge the franchise. You have to fight an election based on the parameters that are laid down for you, regardless of what you may think of them. That is democracy. As I say, I'd urge people who feel strongly about this is going to be a live issue long beyond this referendum, all the way to 2020, as you say. So get involved, make your views known, but it's not really one for the campaign, as I say, because we have to fight based on the franchise that is laid down to us in law, rather than what we may like it to be. It was the same issue with, there was a challenge to try and get young people, 16 and 17 year olds, who you remember had a vote in the Scottish independence referendum. A very similar issue there, but again, we weren't really getting involved in that, because it's, as I say, it's not for us to dictate the franchise, it's for us to argue our case to the British people and indeed Brits living in Spain and elsewhere.
Interestingly, maybe most of our listeners don't know, I think it's the only country, I'm not sure, but in the European Union, the 28 countries, in Austria, 16-year-olds can vote. So rather bizarrely, on issues that affect all of us, in other words, among other things, of course, voting for the European Parliament itself, the 751 or so members, that 16 and 17-year-old Austrians can vote. No other country, I think I'm right in saying no other country in Europe can. Talking of Austria, it was a narrow miss for the far right there after the postal votes came in, 750,000 or so, which swung it slightly in favour of this independent guy supported by the Green Party. But it was a bit of a close call. But looking around, we're not going to go through them all, but in the last general election, the national election in Austria, the Freedom Party, you can by most to be far right, 35.1%. We see just a couple of others. The Finns, 18%. The Sweden Democrats, often lauded as a liberal country, 13% there. The 21% in Denmark, 29% for the Swiss People's Party, even though they're not in the European Union. But around Europe, it seems increasingly that the tide is turning, not just in the UK among Brexiteers, but in Europe, the tide is turning against the European Union. Most of this support for the far right, when you ask them themselves, is about EU immigration policy.
I think you've identified a very worrying trend, as you say, across Europe and indeed in the wider Western world, if you look at the success that Donald Trump is having in the American presidential race. I think it's extremely worrying because I think it's the politics of division that seeks to set people against each other, seeks to stoke fear and suspicion of people from different countries and different backgrounds. And I think there's a big job on for anyone like myself who believes that we're stronger when we group together with our friends and allies in Europe, when we come together as part of the European Union to make our economy stronger, to make our security systems better, to enhance our influence in the world. I think not just in this referendum campaign, which clearly we're doing, but for a long time beyond, those, you know, voices that believe in international cooperation are going to have to speak very loudly because, as you say, the voices of division and fear and the politics of fear are sadly on the rise right across Europe, not just in Britain.
Okay, James, before I let you go, because through no fault of yours, of course, I know that you have to be away before 1:30. I can just say thanks to Richard in London, who's informed us, maybe we both learned something here, Scotland is 16 years old, and Estonia as well. Apparently they can vote from the age of 16. Just before I let you go, we've got Bob on the line on the Costa Blanca in southeastern Spain, and he seems to think the European Union is finished. Go ahead, Bob, you can put your question to James.
Hello, I've just sent you in two attachments to you. You can read it yourselves. It's even worse this morning. The German president is on there saying, it's nothing they can do. It seems they've borrowed 38 billion, and now they've lost that, and it's still going down. And they said that the bank's finished, and they can't help the euro or Europe. And now the Bank of England has been on, and they said they are quite agree Britain be better out as soon as possible than in.
Hang on a minute, Bob, some money. So it's not quite clear. Just to summarise your point, the Bank of England is certainly not saying that Britain would be better off out.
Yeah,
if
as
anything,
well.
Mark
now,
Carney
this,
said
this
the
is the last president of England. He's on internet, and he said that this is the they call this. I'll tell you what they're calling it now. I've sent you it. It's the biggest meltdown of banks ever on record.
Okay.
In England.
Thanks for that, Bob.
All the banks across
James,
Europe.
James, I don't know if you managed to get anything out of that. Let's just perhaps suppose that this is the latest bailout to Greece.
Yeah.
That one of the problems perhaps is Greece and the seeming infinite pit of money that is one of the essential problems at the core of the European Union. I know Britain isn't in the Eurozone, but let's just sort of say the concept of Europe helping out because, as we know, it's not just the European Central Bank and the IMF, but Britain also has a part to play because of the EU aspect itself.
Yeah, look, I'm not going to pretend I followed all of the points that Bob was able to make. I would like to pick him up on one thing. The Bank of England, Mark Carney, the governor of the Bank of England, has been absolutely categorical in the last week that he believes that Britain is far stronger off remaining in the European Union. He said that our economy would go into recession over here if we left. So he could not have been clearer about that. So I think that should be set straight. Look, I think nobody is suggesting that it's a particularly easy time for the European Union or that everything is rosy in the garden. It's not. There's clearly a lot of work to do in the Eurozone countries in particular to put Europe's economy back on an even keel. Britain's not involved in the Eurozone. The Prime Minister of this country in his renegotiation recently secured opt-outs from any future contributions from Britain to any bailouts. I think that's the right position to be in. But I think what you've got to ask yourself is the bigger question. Just because Europe's having a few problems, as indeed there are across the Western world, does that mean you want to throw the baby out with the bathwater? Does that mean you want to rip Britain out of the single market, our home market of 500 million consumers that allows us to trade freely? And I think particularly for your listeners, you know, what's going to happen to those Brits, the well over a million British citizens living and working in Europe? And that's primarily in Spain and France, but it's right across the European Union. You know, what happens to their access to healthcare? What happens to their ability to seek employment freely without any discrimination? What happens to their ability to access public services? Because I think that's very much all up in the air, and the Leave campaign have been unable to offer any guarantees, and I think it's been a missed part of this debate, certainly over in Britain. It's not been a big part of the debate over here. But what happens, as I say, to those well over a million Brits living and working on the continent?
Right. Well, they would say, and apologies because of the clock watching here, but they would argue, of course, I know there are complications in it, but Norway, as I know, there are plenty of Norwegians where I am at the moment physically, and they have an EHIC. They've negotiated a bilateral deal with the European Health Insurance Card. There are many Spanish people working in the UK. There are many British people, many working, but residing here. So a bilateral deal on that would be reached, is what they would say.
And of course,
there's uncertainty, because there's always uncertainty when you're doing something that you've never, ever done before, that nobody has done. So that's maybe an obvious thing to say.
I mean, if they want to say that they would follow the Norwegian rule, then let's have a debate about that. But Norway still pays into the EU budget, which they've said they don't want to do. They still accept EU regulations, which Leave campaigns say they don't want to do. And crucially, Norway accepts freedom of movement of European people, which the Leave campaigns have set their whole campaign against as being the centre point of their campaign. And the idea that what the Leave campaigns want is to say that Spanish citizens will no longer be able to come to Britain to seek work, to seek employment, and use our public services while they are there, but that magically, by some sort of fantasy, that British people will be allowed to go to Spain and do exactly the same. That doesn't seem to me to be entirely credible, that we as a country would say to Spanish people, no thank you, you're not welcome, you're not allowed to come work here and access our public services, but that British people would be welcomed with open arms across the rest of the European Union and allowed to enjoy all the advantages they have today. That doesn't seem to me to stand up to any kind of scrutiny at all.
That's a question that I'll put to our very next guest, Doug Nicholls, who's from Trade Unionists Against the EU, who wants, of course, Britain to leave. I'll put that question to him in just a few moments. In the meantime, James McGrory, Chief Campaign Spokesman for Britain Stronger in Europe. Thanks so much for joining us on TRE. Thank you.
Britain Decides. TRE's coverage of Britain's EU referendum is hosted by Stephen Ridson, with expert guests, speakers from both sides, and your comments. Join in the debate on our online forum at talkradioeurope.com.
Welcome back. It's 12:32 in mainland Spain, an hour earlier in the UK and in the Canary Islands, of course. We're live here on our sixth programme of Britain Decides, discussing the EU referendum coming up on the 23rd of June in the UK. If you want to join in the conversation, as always, you're very welcome to call us on 952-78-4000. You can tweet using the hashtag Britain Decides. Or you can, in fact, send an email as well to studio@talkradioeurope.com, where Rob will see your comments. And one final thing, on our forum as well. There's no excuse not to express your opinion on our forum. That's at talkradioeurope.com, and you'll click on the link you'll see above the fold on the first page. Well, now we're joined by Doug Nicholls, who's the chair of Trade Unionists Against the European Union. He's a former general secretary of the General Federation of Trade Unions. Afternoon, Doug.
Good afternoon to you, Steve, and all your listeners.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Let's dive right in. I understand that you fear for the future of the NHS, the National Health Service, if Britain remains in Europe. Why is that?
Well, there's two main reasons. When the constitutional attempt failed to introduce an EU constitution and it became the Lisbon Treaty, that was really code for trying to finish off the privatisation programme throughout Europe, but particularly in Britain, where key parts of our society are still in the public sector. Most important of all, the National Health Service and schools. So the Lisbon Treaty, in our view, started to target the privatisation of the NHS and schools, and that has gone on apace. But more dramatically, 9 years ago, the European Union entered into secret talks with the United States of America to develop something called the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, which has nothing to do with trade, but everything to do with putting the corporations into absolute power over government and over the EU Commission itself. Now, that's significant because it seeks to privatise the health service. The biggest lobbyists of the private corporate sector in America and the European Union are the health companies, the health-related companies that benefit from the privatisation of health, particularly in the US and in other places, but have now got their eyes set against our National Health Service. So they are some of the reasons why we're particularly concerned. And, of course, the recent imposition of or attempted imposition of new contracts for junior doctors was a signal that they want to soften up the workforce, make the terms and conditions more flexible to make privatisation more possible.
Well, OK, before we get on to, say, workers generally, regarding the NHS, TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, which doesn't, even by Barack Obama's most optimistic estimate for those who want it to go ahead, is 2017, maybe the middle of 2017 at the earliest. When there was that leak that was given to, I think, Greenpeace, and then it was published in The Guardian, and then everybody else had it, certainly in the UK version. Immediately after that, the French trade minister, the German agriculture minister came out and said that the United States is not ceding enough, it's not giving enough away on its side of the bargain, and therefore, as it stands, they're opposed to it. There are many others, the Green parties that have much power, indeed the new president, only just in Austria, is supported by the Greens. If anything, safeguards against such a deal, if you don't like the TTIP and investor-state dispute settlement-type deals, which you go into maybe another time, the details of that. If you don't like those, the European Union is a guarantee, well, not a guarantee, but it is more of an insurance against that. One of the greatest champions of TTIP is David Cameron and his government. And when the Leave people, such as Michael Gove, Boris Johnson, Nigel Farage, and their supporters in the media like Melanie Phillips and Kelvin McKenzie, they are all in favour of doing a deal with the United States, a bilateral trade deal, which they're very optimistic about doing soon. And there's every indication that it would have all of that that TTIP has. So what difference does it make there?
Well, I can't speak for all those others on the Leave side. All I can say is that from our side, and that is, as it were, the trade union and the labour movement side, we've been in it a lot longer than them. We started campaigning on this matter in 1973, 75. What's that, 20 or so years before UKIP was formed, and long before some of those that you've mentioned took a policy against the European Union. Now, we need to be clear that the European Union's constitution and its treaties are unique in the world in that they're built on a political economic philosophy. Some would call it neoliberalism. That means the complete operation of the market in all spheres of life. So that's why, since we joined the European Union, our nationalised industries and our public sector in Britain and throughout Europe in many, many places have been liberalised, have been privatised, the profit from them removed from public hands and put into private pockets. Now, that is an unrelenting constitutional requirement of the European Union.
Yeah, but don't you think you've got a better chance of fighting that with your fellow trade unionists around Europe than in the UK, subject to the mercy of a Westminster government? Really, are you seriously saying that since Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, and of course Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, and then David Cameron, that the United Kingdom is less neoliberal than your typical European Union government?
No, it's been at the advance guard of some of the worst things, as you rightly point out. But of course, let's take one early thing from the Thatcher government, as you've mentioned it. October the 23rd, 1979, exchange controls on capital were lifted by the Thatcher government. Now, you could say that that was a pioneering act of the kind of new politics that Mrs. Thatcher had at that time, but it's also an absolute requirement of the European Union that countries do not protect the flow of capital, that do not focus them on investment in their own countries and their own industry, but let them fly onto the lucrative, speculative international money markets. The consequence of that decision alone, many of your listeners will remember, in terms of the deindustrialisation of Britain, quicker bucks could be made by gambling on the money markets than they could be by investing in our long-term industry, farming and agriculture, which, of course, takes longer investment strategies.
OK, we've got a comment come in from Kate, a listener on the Costa Blanca. Rob Humphreys, producer in Marbella, has that comment. Rob, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Stephen. Hi, Doug. It's very interesting. We had Professor David Abulafia on last week, who was a historian who was very strongly in favour of leaving the EU. But Kate on the Costa Blanca has picked up this point, which has been in all the papers, about these 300 prominent historians who've written to the newspapers today, saying that a vote to leave would condemn the UK to a future of international irrelevance. And I guess that's the concern for some people who are looking at the Remain argument.
Go ahead, Doug.
Yes. Okay, well, for every 300 historians, economists or politicians on one side, you can get 300 on the other.
But you don't. Every international body, it seems, well, maybe not every, but most, one after the other, they do seem to be drip-feeding them, fair enough, to keep it relevant and in the news. But they all seem to be on the Remain side.
Yes, but let's look at those bodies. Let's look at the IMF and what it's done to Greece, Spain and Portugal and Ireland and many other countries throughout the world with its structural adjustment programs, breaking up public services, breaking up investment in domestic economies, requiring an end to collective bargaining and lower terms and conditions for workers and so on. Some of these devastating bodies that are fully in favour of the neoliberal agenda of the European Union are, very unsurprisingly, supporting it to the hilt. We know that the big funders of the Remain campaign and some of the best promoters of the Remain campaign are the very banks, the Goldman Sachs, the JP Morgans and all the rest of them, that caused the crisis in 2008. They are in charge in America, they're in charge in Britain and they're in charge in the European Union because there's been a shift away from national investment in productive economies to the banks and the finance houses who rule the roost.
Okay, Doug. Well, I'll put that. Just one question, because I said I'd put it to you from our previous guest. Just briefly, if you could, because of the time. If the United Kingdom leaves the European Union, then one of the things that will happen is that Spanish citizens, among the other, of course, 27 members, or 26 of them, Spanish citizens living in the UK wouldn't have the right to just go and live and work there with the same conditions and benefits and whatnot. So there's every reason to believe that Spain would say, well, fine. So therefore, Brits living in Spain wouldn't have those rights either. Can you understand expat concerns, at least?
Yes, I can definitely understand those kind of concerns, but whether anyone has got an absolutely definitive answer to exactly what would happen on those levels, I don't really know, because there'd be so many elements of transitional arrangements and new agreements being made that one can't predict the outcome of them. I wouldn't have thought that any government post-EU membership by Britain would take an aggressive stance to those citizens from Britain originally living in their countries. Why would they want to do so? They have no interest in doing so. Our expats in many countries in Europe make a valuable contribution to the local economy and culture. Why on earth would anyone want to say that?
Okay, I suppose the argument there would be, if you're here already, wherever you are, then you can stay, but this would maybe apply more stricter rules to new arrivals. Doug Nicholls, Chair of Trade Unionists Against the European Union, thanks so much for joining us here on Talk Radio Europe. You're going to have to leave it there. Speak to you soon. Bye-bye.
Pleasure, Steve. Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
Britain Decides. You're listening to Britain Decides, the EU referendum debate on TRE.
Welcome back. It's 12:46. We're live, as always. Remember, the number to call is 952-78-4000. Fret not, you'll be in the front of the queue if you don't manage to get in. And tomorrow we'll be having an edition of Britain Decides Extra, which will just be you and me on our Todd together, without all our pesky qualified guests. I jest, of course. Thanks also for pointing out, many of you have. I'm very pleased to see that news media around the world in the last 48 hours has been quoting this programme from the local France 24, TV service. Bank in France as well, Libération newspaper, Swiss Info, and as far afield as Singapore and the Straits Times and the Times of India as well, quoting you and many of our guests that have appeared on Britain Decides on Europe Today. Now, I'm joined by the economist Vicky Price. She's held many significant roles, including joint head of the UK Government Economic Service in Britain. And she was responsible for encouraging measures that promoted greater productivity in the UK economy. She's written a book as well. She's originally from Greece, went to the UK, I understand, when she was 17 years old. And she's still very much interested in Greece and its relations with the Eurozone. She wrote a renowned book, an acclaimed book in 2012 called Greekonomics. Vicky Price joins us now. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hi. Can I just jump in because of the time, as you see, and apologies for keeping you waiting. There's a question which a listener of ours, and he's not the only one, has asked for. This is our sixth program, a series of 10 programs every Wednesday. And he's asked this question and made this point, and I haven't really had a satisfactory answer. As an economist, a world-renowned economist, maybe you'd be the ideal person. What he says, this is John from Mika, so unfortunately he's not on the line at the moment. He says, he frequently mentions the car industry, say the German car industry, and says, when it comes to tariffs, why would, because the European Union exports more to the UK than the other way around, why would they impose tariffs on British products when, if they did that, German car manufacturers would go to Angela Merkel and say, hang on, you're harming our industry, put pressure on the rest of the EU to keep those tariffs between us as low as possible. Could you answer that question?
Oh, it's a very sensible question, in fact. So, and the answer, you know, you just can't give it is a very straight sort of response, because, of course, we don't know exactly how the governments in the various countries will respond to Britain leaving. But, of course, they are entitled to have tariffs of up to 10%. What this will mean, of course, is that our own exports to them will become more expensive, and therefore competitiveness will increase in places like Germany. But, yes, indeed, they would want to sell things to us as well. So I would suspect that some compromise will definitely be reached. But it also highlights, I think his question highlights, why it is that we actually need to think very hard about what implications might be for all sorts of sectors if we were to vote to leave. And the real point is that in terms of goods, it is quite true that there's been quite a substantial reduction in tariffs all around the world because of pressure from the World Trade Organization. Where we will be considerably more disadvantaged is in what happens in the services side. And, of course, the UK is very, very strong in that area. And that single market in services has just not been completed yet. And there are many more moves right now to achieve that completion. The non-tariff barriers, which already are there but are being dismantled, will exist in the future for us. And that is going to be pretty bad in terms of our overall trade position. I think the question, therefore, is quite right in terms of cars. It may not be quite right in terms of all sorts of other things, and we may have to negotiate that one by one.
I understand, in fact, rather bizarrely, it's sort of counterintuitive that the figures for 2014... 46 billion of exports in car related materials and 47 billion in imports. In other words, in fact, in the car industry, it's pretty similar, the imports and exports. The difference being that the British exports are not necessarily finished products, finished cars, but all the bits and pieces that go towards making that up. One of the concerns, Vicky, is of course TTIP. We've had this leak to Greenpeace, which was then published by various newspapers and media. Regarding the conditions of these secret negotiations, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, that is maybe, even if it goes ahead, at least a year away from being ratified, and the investor-state dispute settlement, which briefly for our listeners, in very simple terms, if I'm going to invest $100 million in a developing country and I'm not confident in the government and the judicial system there, I'll say, I'll put the money in as long as if we've got a dispute over my investment and you changing the laws to take my money away, we can have that in an ISDS court. For example, in London on the Strand is, I think, the busiest one in the world. Fair enough. And those countries say, we'll abide by that in order to get this investment in the first place. How is that appropriate for Europe? In other words, international corporations, not just American ones, but other European ones, they don't trust our judiciary in the 28 members of the European Union?
Well, that is indeed the sticking part. And what people are worried is that those courts, if you like, are going to be used in places, for example, like the NHS, where we may want to block some new private sector from doing those things, if you like, from abroad. And they could then say, well, I mean, we entered the country, you know, expecting to be doing A, B, and C, and now you're telling us we can't. And if indeed they're allowed to do something, and then there is a change of government, which then makes it more difficult. And there are protests in all sorts of other areas to do with TTIP, which have to do with environmental issues, importing food from states that we don't think it's done the right way in terms of the way it's been processed and the way in which the animals have been fed, etc., which are worrying many countries in Europe. So the UK is worried, or some people in the UK are worried about the TTIP implications overall. And you can see, of course, that Germans are protesting against it, and so are the French. So the interesting thing is that certainly from the UK's perspective, there have been lots of reassurances that the NHS is, in fact, out of bounds. So we won't have that type of reaction. But frankly, there are also concerns in the US. So people are anticipating that, in fact, nothing will be signed for the next presidential elections in the US. And therefore, the changes that people want to see happen will be kicking to the longer grass, like, and we won't actually have an agreement on that for quite some time. But there is now increasing transparency about what some of these things are as a result of all these concerns that people have expressed. The question about Brexit is that we here in the UK, sort of the government says, well, we can have a much, much faster agreement with the US if we were to leave the EU, because it's taking so long. But actually what we definitely want to see is that protection that we'd like to see is carries on if there is indeed, we become a sort of sole negotiators with the US, because of course they will have the upper hand. We won't be part of a bigger group which is trying to ensure that it works well and to the benefit of Europe.
Okay, well, it's been sadly all too short. We've still got about a minute or two, and hopefully we'll have you to ourselves perhaps another time, Vicky. But one of your many areas of expertise is, of course, Greece. We just had confirmation after this marathon meeting, I think it lasted until about 2 o'clock in the morning last night, that €10.3 billion has been released to Greece. This is because the IMF has basically backed down a little bit. I understand the IMF said, we're not going to give our part, our tranche, if the European Union, the Eurogroup certainly, insists on imposing even tougher austerity measures on Greece. From pressure from Germany, it seems, come out of that meeting, the IMF has backed down. In your opinion, is it maybe more feasible for Greece to maybe revert to the new drachma, to leave the Eurozone, or for us to forgive large swathes of this debt? How is it conceivable that Greece will ever be able to get back on its feet with this pressure from the European Union?
Well, I think the most important thing from the discussions is that in terms of debt reprofiling and restructuring, the IMF is now reasonably satisfied that will ease the burden on Greece, because otherwise the whole debt situation is unsustainable. And under that scenario, the IMF cannot, in fact, be involved in any further bailout, can't take part in the one that's just been agreed, because it would be forbidden from doing so, because the country would be in trouble in the future. So at least that reprofiling will happen. But I think in the longer term, you're quite right, what Greece needs to do is really see some of that debt written off completely. I think it will happen at some point. But leaving and joining, and having to currency, I don't think will do it.
Vicky Price, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. My apologies. We'll speak to you soon, and indeed to all our listeners. Tomorrow you'll be able to call us live here on Talk Radio Europe. Hasta mañana.